Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by Timothy Egan. He is a National Book Award winning New York Times bestselling author. He is out with a brand new book. This one is called A Fever in the Heartland, The Ku Klux Klan's Plot to Take Over America and the Woman Who Stopped Them. It's a lot of information available in that subtitle. The book's available everywhere. And Tim, the KKK of the 1920s, this is one of the things that I found, one of the many things I found interesting about this book. Can you describe how they resembled the KKK of the 19th century that I think a lot of us studied in school, the post-Civil War KKK? What did they resemble in the 20s?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting because the original KKK was essentially a violent terror group that was a reaction to African Americans being freed, and suddenly they were citizens, and they went and burned buildings and merchants and fire-branded people's foreheads and did all kinds of awful stuff. President Grant destroyed them by 1872, and they disappeared. They essentially were gone for 50 years. The Klan of the 20th century was much bigger and appeared 50 years later in the early 1920s. And it was a reaction to immigrants, mainly from Southern Europe, Italians, and Eastern Europe, Jewish people, and to the Great Migration, people moving north, and to the social liberation of women because of, they'd just been given the vote. And so it kind of came out of nowhere in reaction to these social trends, and it was a huge Klan. And they almost, in some ways, an everyday Klan, because a lot of, people who, you wouldn't otherwise characterize as Klansmen belong to this organization.
Well, it almost reminded me of the Prohibition people, the ones that would talk teetotaler, but then they'd be sneaking whiskey. You'd go to you'd see people wearing these hoods, and it was local businessmen, local successful people who were part of this organization. And I think there's a tendency to believe that it's a social organization and people, when they want to rewrite history, but the Klan of the 20s, they were far more than a social organization, right?
That's an interesting point, because the Klan, it was the golden age of fraternal orders, these secret societies which were largely benign, like Oddfellows and Elks and Red Men, and these people had silly rituals and, they exchanged secret handshakes. The Klan modeled themselves somewhat after that. But again, as you said, there were merchants and teachers and coaches and bankers, and they had a women's brigade, they had a children's brigade, but they were a terror group. They still did, awful things. They firebombed people's houses. They ran folks out of town. They had a lynching every now and then. And this was in the North. The preponderance of Klansmen in the 1920s was not in southern states. It was in the North. It was in Indiana and Ohio and Minnesota, parts of Iowa. And, that's what surprises many people as they look at this thing now. It grew to 6 million members, by the way. And as you said, they were hypocrites. Their leader of the most powerful Klan organization the world had ever seen, the man I write about, was a con man, a charlatan, an alcoholic, a bootlegger, a rapist, and a murderer, all while professing purity of women and temperance for everyone else.
You're speaking of David C. Stevenson, D.C. Stevenson, and can you kind of introduce us to him? Because all of us in Iowa are familiar with the Music Man, and he's sort of like a Harold Hill, the charlatan who comes in and kind of sweeps everybody off their feet. But what was he like in the grand scheme of things?
It's funny you said the Harold Hill one, because as I wrote this book, I started to think of him as a music man of hate. We got trouble right here in River City. This guy was a complete drifter who just rolled into town with no past. And within 4 years of arriving, as a phantom in the state of Indiana, he ruled the state. He had a governor under his thumb. He had the entire legislature. It was a Klan legislature. He had all members of Congress under his control. So he was kind of a music man. He was a gifted charlatan. One man said he was the most talented sociopath north of the Ohio River. He had a way to say things that people wanted to hear. And he grew to be the Grand Dragon, in his 4 short years, of the largest realm of the Klan the world had ever seen.
The Klan at the time, where did their money come from, their financial support, other than dues?
So, two ways, and this is why I think D.C. Stevenson became a Klansman and ultimately the most powerful Grand Dragon they'd ever seen. He had to pay dues, as you mentioned. And that was equivalent to one person's wages, in some cases, half a week's wages. So it was not for poor people. You had to be middle class generally to join this Klan of the 1920s. But they also shook people down on their robes and their uniforms. And D.C. Stevenson got a huge cut of that. So, you know, he tried a whole bunch of different schemes. Finally, he seized on this hate group as the thing. And within those 4 years, he went from a nobody with nothing to a multimillionaire who had his own Klan plane, a 98-foot yacht, and a giant mansion in the most desirable neighborhood in Indiana. So it was a real money-making scheme as well.
Before we get into the other part of your subtitle, the woman who took down the Klan, the people at the time, there were obviously people who were against the Klan, but where did their opposition come from, and did it have any legs?
Yeah, you know, I'm always looking for the heroes in the story and not just the villain. I'm always interested in the push-pull of American history, good versus evil. And there were a lot of folks who opposed them. The Klan targeted Catholics, remember. So Catholic organizations, clergy and nuns, and a very charismatic Irish-American Catholic lawyer named Patrick O'Donnell started this group called Tolerance. And they were a fusion of blacks, Catholics, and Jews, basically the people who were targeted by the Klan. And they pushed back. They unmasked the invisible empire. They revealed their names in their weekly newspaper and did everything they could to stop them. But every one of them failed. They all took these big swings at the Grand Dragon, and every one of them failed. The NAACP came into town and said, we're going to stop voting Republican. Blacks, remember, had been the most reliable voting bloc for the Republican Party in the first 50 years after the Civil War. So every one of these big organizations took swings at them, and every one of them failed. So at the peak of my story in 1925, they went out there to stop the Klan. They were on top, and their scheme was to ultimately put someone in the White House.
I'm chatting with Timothy Egan about his new book, A Fever in the Heartland, The Ku Klux Klan's Plot to Take Over America and the Woman Who Stopped Them. It's available everywhere. Tim is a National Book Award winner. He's also a Pulitzer winner. Where do you keep these awards? Do you have them in front of you when you write, or are they just kind of parts of your past that you take out once in a while?
No, you don't think about that when you write them. It's just nice to find an audience and you're happy with people recognizing. You know, writing is a solitary pursuit, largely. You're with yourself. You're inside your head and these characters. What I do is I go back and I time travel and I try to pull these people from the past and make them real.
So Madge Oberholzer, the female heroine of your story, the heroine of your story. Can you introduce us to her?
Yeah, you know, I'm really interested in people who live at the margins of history. I've written a lot of books about the major players. You know, Teddy Roosevelt was one of my heroes. I wrote a book about him in a fire, and I wrote about his fifth cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, in my Dust Bowl book. But I'm also interested in the people who get written out of the story. And in this case, it was Madge Oberholzer. She was 28 years old, a single woman, living at home with her parents in Irvington, Indiana. She had no real power. She was a feisty, kind of semi-flapper, you know, woman of her age, independent. She took a road trip across the country when that was considered a real daring thing for a single woman to do. But her job was on the chopping block. And the only way to save her state job, she had a literacy program that helped rural communities, was to go to the Grand Dragon, the man who ruled the state, who was also the Klansman. But no legislation passed in Indiana without the approval of the top Klansmen. So the two fates cross. And I won't tell you what happens in the very end, but a horrible crime is committed. And he was, as I said, D.C. Stevenson was a con man. Behind the surface, he was a rapist. He was an alcoholic. He was a cannibal. And he was a murderer. And so these two forces cross. Ultimately, Madge's words in a court of law are the things that bring this guy down. And history would not have turned out the way it did had it not been for the brave words of this one woman, Madge Oberholzer.
Well, a lot of this book reads like a courtroom drama, like a legal thriller. And I kept thinking about you going back and looking at transcripts of trials and court proceedings from the 1920s. What did that look like to research? Because it's not as clean as reading a transcript that's made today, I can imagine.
No, it really isn't. And most of it, this was the trial of the century in Indiana. So I benefited from some really good newspaper accounts. All the major papers in the country, not just in Indiana, but in New York and D.C., they sent correspondents to the little town of Noblesville, Indiana, which is population 5,000, to cover this trial of the century. So I had really good press accounts as well as transcripts. Some transcripts, not all, because half of the transcripts in this trial of the century has been lost. But I'm thank you for touching on that, because I thought it was riveting. My heart was jumping. My heart was leaping as I was reading part of this. And I'll be honest with you, I modeled the last third of the book after a John Grisham-like legal thriller, because to me, we didn't know how this was going to turn out. They were underdogs against the world. They thought the jury was full of Klansmen, and they were up against the political establishment, this brave prosecutor. But that really helped, because you had all the court testimony, and you had all the back and forth, and you had all the closing arguments, and you had all the atmosphere in the courtroom. You know, everybody smoked, and so there was this blue haze of smoke over this tiny little courtroom, and the gun-toting members of D.C. Stevens Brigade who would threaten people. So it was a real incredible atmosphere.
Did you find, as you looked at coverage, that some was more sympathetic to one side versus the other, or how did you sift through all that?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there were not just a few, but many, many Klan-sympathetic newspapers. And one of them was Noblesville, where the trial took place. They had a daily paper. Most small towns then had daily papers. And they, at one point, they would run a column almost every day called Klan Comment, K-O-M-M-E-N-T, spelled with a K. And it was largely a pro-Klan comment saying, and at one point they said to everyone in the area, whose side are you on? It's time to take sides. Do you want to be with this noble organization that represents good people, or do you want to be with these rebels? So, yeah, I mean, there were papers that absolutely took the side of this rapist and killer and this terror man.
As you put together this and you did your research, do you find a lot of the newer history about the Klan is rewritten to shape a certain narrative, or is the Klan's history what it is?
You know, we're having this big debate about our past and how we should teach our past. I think this is one of these episodes that we shouldn't be afraid to confront, because ultimately I think it makes us stronger as a people. You know, good triumphed over evil in this case. We beat the bad guy. But it was largely forgotten because a lot of us go through historical amnesia and we don't want to remember the bad episodes. So this thing really fell into the mist of time. Now it's been somewhat resurrected. I mean, it's there in the archives of Indiana. They don't necessarily want to teach it in the schools, but it was their trial of the century. They were the most Klan-infested state in the world by far. 1 in 3 white males in Indiana wore the sheets of the Klan. So the story is there, and when people write about the history of the Klan, they most scholars now recognize that the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, was the peak.
It's an amazing book, an amazing story, and it's put together in such a readable format here. This book is called A Fever in the Heartland, The Ku Klux Klan's Plot to Take Over America and the Woman Who Stopped Them by Timothy Egan. It's available everywhere. Tim, fantastic book, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Brian, great interview. Thank you for your interest.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. That justice is the one thing you should always find. You